Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of Guftagu, a new podcast series in collaboration with the Pakistan Society. Guftagu means conversation, and this series is centered around conversations about South Asian identity, culture, and social issues. This week, we're talking to Maria Saleem, a researcher and activist, about the CAA and NRC in India. To start off, tell us a bit about the NRC and the CAA and why it's being opposed by progressive groups in India and internationally.
So the CAA, or the Citizenship Amendment Act, was passed by the Indian Parliament last year. And what it essentially does is it amends the Citizenship Act of 1955, and it lays down religion as a criteria of granting citizenship. But there are three things that you have to remember here. It grants citizenship to everybody but Muslims. So it explicitly states that Christians, Hindus, Buddhists, Sikhs, Parsis, and Jains from only Bangladesh, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, those of these people who have come to India before 31st of December 2014 would be given citizenship if they can prove that they were persecuted. What it essentially does by laying this out is it completely alienates Muslims and doesn't even talk about Muslims who might be facing persecution in these countries, which they do. I mean, we all know about the Ahmadis in Pakistan, and we know about, well, China's not even mentioned. We know about the Uyghur Muslims in China, etc. That's one. People say, why is it that you know you're worried? Because this is a law which applies to people who are coming from outside of India. Well, then we have to look at how the government is linking it with the NRC, or the National Registry of Citizens, whereby huge detention centers are being created for those people who are unable to prove their citizenship. So you have to look at both of these together, and that's where the trouble begins.
And I think it's important, the point you bring up about how certain Muslims within these countries are also facing oppression. And that sort of, access to citizenship doesn't exist for other minorities that exist in those countries as well. You could talk about, atheists in these countries. Yes. You could talk about Jewish people. You could talk about, there's other minorities as well who could benefit from this sort of policy, but they're being excluded, and that there's a very clear agenda regarding that. And I think it's important to talk about how that affects, Indian identity, what it means to be Indian. What do you think about how, legislation like that can impact that?
So in India now, there's like a constant struggle really to prove your Indianness. As an Indian Muslim woman, I've been facing this more than I have ever faced this. So I've been looking for a house, for instance, for rent for myself. It's been 5 months, and the struggle is constant. When I go to look for a house for myself, I've been denied housing, and people have openly said, well, NRC is coming and you're a Muslim, why don't you live in your own area, and things of that sort. If you look at all the protests that are happening, you go to Shaheen Bagh, which the world is talking about, there are about 20 more protest sites. These protest sites are filled with Muslim women and Muslim children, and you see them holding the constitution, you see them holding the flag. There's this constant struggle of proving your nationalism, because you're saying that, as Muslims, we are asking for what we're asking, not just as Muslims, but as Indian citizens. You're taking away our right as Indian citizens, and that's that constant dialogue that's happening in the country. And it's very heartbreaking to have to prove your citizenship because of a religion that you're born into.
Of course. And you mentioned Shaheen Bagh and the, efforts to mobilize against the sort of repression that's happening. And you've personally been involved in organizing around India, right? What do you think some of the challenges you faced were when you were trying to mobilize people, when you were trying to organize protests?
One of the biggest challenges that a lot of us have been facing around protests is that our right to protest has completely been trampled upon. It's a democratic right. We do peaceful protests. We do peaceful organizing, candlelight marches, quiet sit-ins, reading of the preamble. There have been times when the police has attacked people who are making like a little rangoli or a colored thing on the road which says no CAA, no NRC. It says things like save the constitution, and people have been attacked. It's almost as if we have to understand that there's a difference between being against the country and being against the government's policies. in this case, being against the government's policies is being taken as being against the country, which is one of the biggest issues that we have been facing as while organizing. But despite these challenges, people have been coming out in large numbers to support what's being done, because what we're asking are constitutional rights, and we are asking them peacefully. So I think that's where we are winning in many ways.
Of course. And with the Indian police, with the state institutions, with even the media, you know, slandering essentially the protesters, the activists who are involved in all of this within this entire larger context, it's really scary to think about how that's impacting individual liberties. And then when you involve, you know, the recent protests that have happened in JMU and, you know, among student groups, it's frightening, really, in many ways.
It is very frightening because, so there's a quote by Justice Mulla, who's a judge, and in the 1950s, 60s, he said that and it's not me saying, he said it, that the UP police is one of the most organized criminal gangs, if you will. And what the police, the kind of violence that the police has been perpetrating on the protesters, it is scary. There's tear gas that's been used. There are water cannons that those have been used. I've been personally involved trying to look at a case of 15 young Muslim men and one older gentleman who were picked up from a protest site because they were present there. And the kinds of things that they had to face while they were in jail, and how long it took us to help them get bails. And when they did get bails, they got them because there was zero proof of their involvement in anything. And they were in jail for 3 weeks. And God alone knows what all they would have had to face in the jails. And students, the kind of violence that has been brought upon students, it is scary. It's not easy to go to a protest. You know that you can be beaten up. There's going to be lathi charge on you. Just 3 days back, JMI female students, there have been interviews of them saying that, and they've been saying this, that we've been beaten by the police on our private parts. They keep saying it, and they say our private parts are swollen. So it's really scary to even, listen to these things, let alone be in their position.
And I think that's important for, you know, students who are living in countries where mm-hmm. activism is somewhat, of course, you know, the police will still be there. It'll still be difficult to organize. But there's still, you know, some relative freedom here for, you know, the diaspora or international students who are studying here. There's still the opportunity to voice dissent. What do you think about the efforts that have been made in places like London amongst wider South Asian communities, amongst student groups, and what, you know, those networks mean for solidarity?
A lot of us have been following what students and the diaspora in the US and the UK have been doing. Solidarities are always welcome. I don't know of what the outcome of your solidarity is going to be, but the fact that there is solidarity coming from across the globe is extremely, extremely important. When there's a little, when we see, even on social media, when we see a little, we stand with Shaheen Bagh, or we stand with students of JMI and JNU and AMU, it does make you feel nice. It makes you feel like there are others who are listening to our troubles. And it's not just our story is not confined in this little bubble that we are in. People are listening to what's happening. I wish more can be done. And I think there is a lot of scope of these solidarities being converted into more actionable solidarities. There can be, we can talk about how those things can be done. But yes, I really think it really pulls up the morale of those who are seeing these solidarities back home.
I think what you said about, you know, actionable solidarity, stuff that can be done. There's this criticism that you might hear here now and then about how for those who live in other countries, those who are part of the diaspora, whatever they do to protest stuff that governments are doing back home, it's more symbolic than anything. And I do see where that reluctance comes about when it comes to getting involved personally in these things, because then the question is, what am I really accomplishing? Is this enough? So, you know, what would your response to that be? How do you think this sort of action can be translated into greater action, more meaningful action?
You know, a lot of my non-Muslim friends, and they openly say this, those who are part of the movement, they say how a lot of times they are all part of these WhatsApp groups where their own families are pro-CAA, pro-NRC. So maybe it's awareness raising is extremely important. You know, we are done speaking to the choir. You have to speak to those people who do not agree with you. So this is, it'll be a huge achievement if a lot of people, whether here or in different parts of the world, start speaking to their own families and telling them, you know what, these laws are not just anti-Muslim. They are essentially anti-Muslim, but they're anti-Dalit, they're anti-poor, and they're anti-marginalized. Because we have to remember that Dalits, Adivasis, because of the kind of social stigma that they face and the kind of lives that they have been living for the past so many years, documentation is extremely difficult for them to get. What about the homeless? Documentation difficult for them. For sex workers, documentation is difficult for them to get. So it's not just it to say that it doesn't affect me, it's not it only affects Muslim is also not correct. So you have to bring that dialogue with your families. That's important. Secondly, again, you know, as students, use your, if some of you are in studying law, use your research skills and help us with because our fight is keeping the constitution in our hand. So, you know, use the constitution, use the laws, fundamental rights, etc., that are mentioned in the constitution, and help us with, you know, I mean, we've been doing that back home. But draw up pamphlets on what CAA is, what is NRC, why is it unconstitutional, why is it anti-India to be supportive of these things. So those are small little things that you can do. Then things can be learned from the US as well, like the Seattle City Council passed an anti-CAA resolution. And that was huge. It gave a lot of boost of morale to us back home. So, there are lots of things that can be done. And just standing and protesting also, peaceful protest in solidarity with your people, that is us back home. It makes a big difference to us.
Yeah, and I think it's important to remember that these are the rights we have and to exercise them. When you have these rights, when you have this sort of access, it's important to use it for the greater good in whatever ways you can. So, to end, I thought it would be important to mention the election in Delhi that mm-hmm. happened recently and what that means for the BJP and, you know, the future of these movements that have been mobilizing in response to the CAA and the NRC. What do you think about that?
I don't want to be very cynical, so mm-hmm. I will give you both sides of what I think. It's a big thing that the BJP lost the Delhi elections, because a lot of the election material, the speeches, were based on hate. A lot of them were putting Muslims against the rest of the country, because if you looked at their pamphlets, it almost said BJP, it said person contesting and a Hindu name. And then the other parties, where they didn't have the names, they just wrote Muslim candidate, Muslim candidate. What does that mean? You know, so they were peddling hate. And what the Aam Aadmi Party, or the party that won, did was they were talking about development. They have not taken a very clear stand on CAA, on NRC, but they haven't been peddling hate as much. So we're hopeful that now that Mr. Arvind Kejriwal, who's the chief minister, is in power again, he will stand up and say things about Jamia students being beaten up, about police brutality. I know the police doesn't come under him. It's national capital, it comes under the Home Ministry. But as the chief minister of the state, I hope he openly and clearly takes a stand and stands with the constitution and stands with fundamental rights of individuals who are protesting against a basically anti-India law.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us, and we hope you enjoyed today's episode. This episode, we talked to Maria Saleem about the NRC and CAA in India. The music for this episode is from Lighter Matches by the Tamash Beans. I'm your host, Angbeen Abbas, signing off. To hear more from us, subscribe to The Beaver Sound on Spotify.